Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 4:06 following news, Kirk Heinze talks with the leaders of Detroit's Restaurant of the Year and Ford Motor Company's Autonomous Vehicles Unit. And Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis talk about keeping student athletes healthy, both physically and mentally, with MSU's lead athletic trainer Sally Nogle and Spartan football team physician and MSU neurologist David Kaufman.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
MSU Today begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
The 2016 Detroit Free Press Metro Chevy Dealers Restaurant of the Year is obviously exceptional in many ways, including Sandy Levine, who's the proprietor and front of the house manager of Chartreuse Kitchen and Cocktails in Midtown Detroit. Sandy, congratulations on the Free Press recognition and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I have some good friends who recently dined at the Chartreuse and are still raving about it. Tell us a little how you got started and a little bit about the philosophies that undergird your business.
We have a cocktail bar in Ferndale called the Oakland, and a couple of the regulars from there really urged me to come see the space that was becoming available in the Park Shelton building. We weren't really planning on, taking on another project like that, but at their more or less insistence, we looked at the space and, immediately kind of fell in love with it. It's sort of limiting. The kitchen there is really, really small. So, initially I wasn't even really sure whether, we'd be able to run a, full kitchen out of there. But it ended up, we talked to some chef friends of ours and we, figured out a way to make it work. And I was hooked up with Doug Hewitt, our chef, through James Rigato, who runs the Maple Gray in Hazel Park. And, Doug has not only done an amazing job in terms of, just the food that's coming out of the kitchen, but just operating out of such an incredibly small space with such limited storage. He does a really awesome job. So, in terms of Chartreuse, the menu is very, very produce forward, very much farm to table. We work with a lot of smaller local farms, and everything's very bright and vibrant and fresh, both on the menu and, we sort of tried to match that in terms of decor and service as well.
Well, you mentioned the farm to table, and that's right in the wheelhouse of this program. How do you go about identifying the local sources for your foodstuffs? You mentioned some small farms, maybe Eastern Market vendors, but how much is coming out of Detroit and the surrounding area?
A vast majority. And now, obviously, this time of year, it's massive versus, the middle of the winter. We're not the kind of restaurant that says 100% comes out because, avocados from Detroit probably aren't so good. We've also met a lot of really good people, from, within Detroit. It's a vast majority of the produce that we get, comes from either, Detroit or at least Southeast Michigan.
My guest is Sandy Levine. He's the proprietor and front of the house manager for Chartreuse Kitchen and Cocktails, which is the 2016 Detroit Free Press Restaurant of the Year. I was going to ask you about Detroit proper. Urban agriculture is gaining momentum not only in Detroit but across the country. Some people see it as part of the renaissance of Detroit. Are you seeing similar things, the produce that you're getting from Detroit proper, of the quality? I mean, it's going to have to be high quality in order for you folks to buy it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of our most popular dishes is just called Recovery Park. It is, they're an urban farm in Detroit that just does amazing work. Michelle Lutz kind of runs the farm there, and she is brilliant at just growing, really, really delicious produce. And, you know, basically she'll bring some stuff from there, and then our chef will just make a dish out of it. So it's, you know, it's usually some sort of salad or, you know, kind of like a vegetable sort of dish. And that has kind of become, you know, one of the most popular dishes we have. There's the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative that's just right around the corner from us, and, you know, several other farms that are, you know, based out of Detroit that do an awesome job.
So, again, here we have a farm-to-table, an award-winning restaurant, sort of a closed loop. What do you do in the wintertime when things aren't growing so abundantly?
Well, there are still some farms in Detroit that do, you know, grow in, you know, inside of greenhouses or whatever. So we do get some of the produce, you know, from, you know, still from Southeast Michigan and a ton from Eastern Market as well. But in terms of what's in peak season, you know, here, it does go down a little bit, but, you know, the menu also changes, you know, to reflect that as well.
Well, I should probably mention too, Sandy, that you're located on Shelby Street in the Park Shelton, and you're right next door to the Detroit Institute of Arts. What a wonderful location that you folks have. And again, you folks also represent part of this renaissance that's going on in Detroit.
Well, I mean, it's obviously, you know, that's a huge honor to be a part of, you know, all of what's going on here in terms of so many incredible restaurants that have opened up in the last few years and are, you know, in the process of opening up. It seems like, you know, every couple of weeks there's a new place. And, you know, this is the first time in my lifetime that there are so many different places that you could put into other cities, you know, and they would do really, really well. So it's kind of a fun time, you know, to be, you know, living in Detroit, eating in Detroit, and a part of this industry.
Well, frequent visits to Detroit. Next time my wife and I are down there, we're definitely going to book a reservation at Chartreuse Kitchen and Cocktails. I've been talking with Sandy Levine. He's the proprietor and front of the house manager of Chartreuse Kitchen and Cocktails, the 2016 Detroit Free Press Metro Chevy Dealers Restaurant of the Year. Sandy, congratulations again on the award, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Thank you very much, Kirk. Appreciate it.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, a fully autonomous vehicle by 2021, just 5 years from now, is Ford Motor Company's recently announced objective. And here to tell us more is Randy Visentainer. He is the director for autonomous vehicles for the Ford Motor Company. Randy, great to have you on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Randy, when Ford uses the term autonomous vehicles, just for our listeners, exactly what are you talking about?
What we're referring to is the SAE Level 4, which is a fully autonomous vehicle capable of operating without a human driver in a geofence zone, in a constrained area, and that geofence zone is defined by having high-definition maps, which provide us information that we use not only for localization, but also those maps are annotated to provide us with information about rules of the road and objects that aid us in object detection and classification.
And by SAE Level 4, that's the Society of Automotive Engineers Level 4 category.
Correct.
Your CEO, Mark Fields, has talked about the development of these autonomous vehicles as not only transformational for your industry, but very consistent with Henry Ford's original vision. How so?
The original vision, and the Model T exemplifies that, was to enable mobility for the masses, and providing affordable transportation in the Model T was to make a car that was affordable enough that the average American could afford it, and then enable mobility. As we move into, you know, the 21st century, with the trend towards urbanization and population growth, individual personal ownership is not always going to be the optimal solution for mobility in some of these mega cities going forward. And so being able to provide a safe, efficient, affordable means of transportation to get you from, you know, where you are to where you want to be and back again is sort of the vision of Part of the Ford Smart Mobility and autonomous vehicles fit in that vision as being able to provide that safe, efficient, affordable platform.
So the core that holds essentially is the greatest mobility at the lowest cost for the most people.
Correct.
Some automakers are taking, and you know this, a more staged approach to the development of autonomous vehicles. But as I understand it, that's not the case with Ford. Why have you decided to go straight to autonomous? And, you know, I guess we have enough problems with bad drivers as it is. Does that have something to do with the with your plan?
That fits into the equation, but the I should also point out that my responsibility at Ford, when we talk about autonomous vehicles, we look at the entire AV spectrum that SAE has laid out from 0 to 5. And 0, 1, and 2 are what we call the driver assistance features. Those are things like adaptive cruise control, traffic jam assist, park assist, those kinds of things. So I also have groups that work on that is part of the organization. But when we look at really taking the human out of the loop and what is required to deliver the situational analysis, the computational power to assess that environment and make a decision based on the real-time information and this prior map to what is a safe path forward, that hardware and that complexity and what that drives in the vehicle is much greater than the technology that we're developing for the driver assist. And so we looked at one point at this building block approach where you combine driver assist features and you get more advanced features. For example, you take lane keeping that helps you stay centered in the lane and adaptive cruise control with stop and go. You put those two together with some more software enhancements and you get sort of a what we call a traffic jam assist, which, you know, in a low-speed traffic jam maintains the vehicle in the center lane and a safe distance to the vehicle in front. The level of sophistication required to deliver that versus a fully autonomous vehicle is far less. In the autonomous vehicle, you need to have much more sensor to assess what's going on around you. So in addition to the cameras and radars that we have on the DAT, we have the LiDAR, which is a laser equivalent of radar, which gives us very accurate, detailed information in terms of range and reflectivity of the environment that complements the camera and the radar, and it gets us what we call this enhanced situational awareness that you need to make the kind of decisions for an autonomous vehicle. So that's why we looked at it and we said we just don't think we can get there with, you know, making it step by step. We think we need to take what we call the top-down approach and look at full autonomy and then what can we do to make that into something that makes business sense but also enables this mobility solution. And that's where we wound up focusing in on level 4 autonomy. Level 5, just for reference, doesn't have the constraint of operating in this geofence zone, and it's more like anytime, anywhere autonomy. So that's a much more complicated problem. But we took the work we were doing at level 5 and adapted it to level 4, which we think is very containable in 5 years.
When I'm talking with Randy Visentainer, we're talking autonomous vehicles. He is the director for autonomous vehicles for the Ford Motor Company. But as you move to the development of this level 4 in the next 5 years, what are some of the biggest engineering and technical challenges that you folks, that you have looming over the next 5 years to meet that timeline?
One of the challenges we have several challenges. One of them is we're moving from what we call research and advanced work into production. So we've got to, for example, take our research code and turn it into a production code with all of the robustness requirements that we have around production software. So we need to take that process. The other is we need to develop systems that don't rely on a human as the backup. For example, in today's vehicle, if you have an issue with your electronic power assist, you can still steer the vehicle manually. So so the human is the backup. In the case of an autonomous vehicle, where we're not relying on the human to be a backup, there won't even be a steering wheel in the vehicle, then we need to provide redundancy in the vehicle, so a backup steering system. So if there's an issue with the primary steering, we can still steer the vehicle. And so we call that fail functional hardware. So things like steering and brakes, we need the hardware to fail but still be functional. And the way that we're doing that is through a redundancy in the system. And so we're proving all of these technologies out in addition to the AI solution. And then we have to take these sensors like LiDAR, which today aren't what we would consider automotive grade. That's the laser radar, if you will. And so we need to work with the supply base to turn that into something that can operate in the environment and have, you know, the 250,000-mile life, and work in different environmental conditions, temperature, rain, humidity, and so on.
As you roll out these technologies and as you test them, there has been some public concern about how autonomous vehicles at any SAE level are going to be road tested. I know you folks are already doing road testing in Michigan and California, maybe other places, but what can you say to ensure consumers out there about the road testing and the safety of that road testing?
We treat the autonomous vehicles very seriously, as we do all of our prototypes when we go on public roads. In the case of the autonomous vehicle, we have specially trained drivers that are sitting ready to take control of the vehicle. We have the vehicle set up so that there's they can take manual control of the vehicle by grabbing the steering wheel or applying pressure to the brake or throttle, and we even have a disengage button that disengages the software from the vehicle. So the what we call the manual driver is always there and ready to take over. And as a matter of fact, one of the things we do in the testing is we look when the manual driver feels the need to take over, we look at that situation and say, why did they feel the need to take over? And then we then can take that information and make the software more robust, make the system more robust. And our ultimate goal is to not have any takeovers. But until we get there and we have confidence there, we will have the human driver present, ready to take over. In addition to that, we also have an engineer that sits next to the driver, and he is monitoring the system, the sensor functionality, the software, what's the software doing real-time in the vehicle and communicating with the driver. For example, he'll say, I see the traffic light. It's red. The driver says, confirm traffic light. Traffic light's red. So we have this constant dialogue going on in the vehicle where the two are communicating. And so the driver's aware of what is the AV system doing, and the safety driver is monitoring that and may recommend that the safety driver take over the vehicle at some point. So we have this dual process of the driver and the engineer in the vehicle monitoring everything while we're out on public roads.
That's not only fascinating, but it's very reassuring, Randy, in terms of the test driving. You know, again, this is some of the issues that you mentioned that have to be overcome over the next 5 years, but tell our listeners a little bit about how you're expanding your workforce in the Silicon Valley and some of the new acquisitions and partnerships that are being formed to move you along the pathway here.
Sure. So we're expanding both in Dearborn and in our Silicon Valley office. We're leveraging that location because some of the suppliers and partners we're working with are located in Silicon Valley, and it just is easier to be working with them. For example, Velodyne, the LiDAR supplier that we announced an equity stake in, is located not far from our office in Palo Alto. But the core of our team is in Dearborn. And so the Palo Alto office, if you will, is an extension of the Dearborn team, but the core team is here in Dearborn. So they do travel. They go to Arizona and California and test there with the Palo Alto team. But again, it's really led out of Dearborn. So in terms of the acquisitions and partnerships, what we announced the equity stake in Velodyne again. We acquired a machine learning company that's located in Tel Aviv, Israel. They're a very innovative company working in machine learning. They haven't really been working in the AV space. They've been doing a lot of contract work for different companies that have problems, for example, in the manufacturing environment on quality control using machine learning algorithms. But what we see is the skill set and the capability can really help us rapidly move forward with our machine learning for things like occupant detection or, object detection and object classification. Another company that we have a licensing partnership with is Nuremberg Neuroscience, and this one we're really fascinated by. It's not a near term, but it's something that has the potential to really change the whole machine learning, machine vision part of AV. And what Dr. Nuremberg has done is basically, as she said, cracked the retinal code and created a computer algorithm that replicates how the retina processes light to, for example, separate the object of interest from the background and does a vision pre-processing to simplify the information to transmit to the brain for the brain then to do the final processing. We're looking at using her technology in a similar fashion to help us navigate through the world and lessen our dependency on these high-definition maps going forward.
In the context of the Smart Mobility Initiative for Ford, I mean, obviously autonomous vehicles, a huge component of that. But say a little bit about the Smart Mobility Initiative in ways that our listeners might be able to comprehend.
At sort of a high level, the Smart Mobility Initiative has grown out of a series of experiments where Bill Ford, our chairman of the board, had challenged us to look at the mobility of the future. How are we going to enable mobility in a different way? The answer in these megacities, for example, isn't just more cars. There's already many examples of global gridlock. So how can we provide mobility solutions without just saying, let's provide more cars? And so at a very high level, that's kicked off a series of experiments, and out of those experiments grew the Ford Smart Mobility Initiative to look at what are the different ways we can provide mobility, whether it's a multimodal solution that may include an AV, it may include a bike and other forms of mass transit. It may be the AV operating in some kind of ride-hailing or ride-sharing service. It might be a dynamic shuttle. There are several different models that could come to play, and depending on the city and that you're operating in, one set of models make more sense than others. All this is, you know, tied together with data analytics to provide the most efficient, optimal, safe solutions. And many of those involve AVs, but not all of them. And that's really what Ford Smart Mobility is out. And so they look to partner with cities to develop the ideal for their needs, which may be a little different. You know, Chicago versus London may have different needs, different requirements. They have different infrastructure that they're starting with.
Randy, I thank you for your time. It's been a great interview. Maybe we can get back to you a couple years down the road to see how you guys are coming along. I've been talking with Randy Vizentainer. He is the director for autonomous vehicles for the Ford Motor Company. Randy, thanks so much for your time and for being a guest on Greening the Great Lakes. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis now welcome two Spartans to the program to talk about maintaining both the physical and mental health of our student athletes. Sally Nogle is the lead trainer for Spartan Athletics. Dr. David Kaufman is a team physician for Spartan football and an MSU neurologist. Here's Mark Hollis.
The health and safety of all students on campus is at the forefront of thought of President and many others across campus, our student athletes in particular. Joining us today is Dr. David Kaufman and our head trainer, Sally Nogle. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like to go through a number of topics talking about healthcare, talking about maybe some of the perceptions that individuals have and maybe some of the realities of how we address. I'll start with you, Sally. Taking care of a group of 800 student athletes is your responsibility, specifically with football. Talk about the daunting task that is on a daily basis.
Yes, the health care of our athletes is very important, and including the mental health care of our athletes. And so it is, for our 12 certified athletic trainers on our staff, it's a lot of work. We spend millions of dollars actually on their health care. And I think it's probably the best health care they'll ever have in their life because we're readily available every single morning, every single day after practice, with team physicians and with our staff. So their health care is important because they can't stay on the field or the court or in the pool without having their health be there for them to compete.
Concussions is something that we want to go into some detail on the conversation, receiving a lot of national and regional conversation, and well that it should. What are some of the other issues before we go into concussions that really jump to the forefront of concerns that you have in seeing students and student athletes regularly?
I think right now the climate is the mental health aspect is very important. We've realized that it affects everything in their lives if they have mental health issues. It affects their schooling. It affects their family life, their social life. So we've focused on that more the last couple of years, but obviously there'll be still the knee sprains and the shoulder sprains and strains. And so depending on the sport will depend on which body part tends to get injured more.
I want to sort of, before we go to concussions, both of you have children who played sports, and so you've been a parent with that. One with a sport in hockey that's a little bit more collision-oriented, though basketball has its moments with unprotection of getting hit in the head and those kinds of things. So we often think about these injuries as football or these high-profile sports that are getting all the attention. And if you were to think about, and your children are now, you know, doing very, very well beyond their time at college, what kind of advice would you provide to parents of kids who are in the sport about two or three things, given your professional experience, that they should be worried about and looking for as you think about whether it's concussions or it's other kinds of things that would be the, you know, pay attention to and have somebody else sort of assess the situation? Because if you're competitive at all, even as a president, you don't want to give up playing, you know, and you're not always the most honest broker of how you feel. Both from a physical as well as a mental perspective. And so in many ways, you have to be as attentive to what people don't tell you, even now, as healthcare providers for our student athletes, as you were as parents when what your kids didn't tell you about how they felt after a game or a match.
That's a very interesting and intriguing series of questions. Both Sally and I are healthcare providers, and then we're both parents. And balancing that by looking and interacting with our children and trying to be sure that post-athletic event they continue to have stability in their lives is one of the most important things that parents can do. I think any good mentor would be able to look at the people under their charge and figure out, do they continue to do well? Do they continue to have joy in how they're competing? And does it bring balance to their life or does it make them unsettled? I think so. Just as Sally Nogle has said, the mental health aspects of sport needs to be put into the forefront more and more. Do they continue to be balanced? And then following that, knowing whether or not your student athlete that happens to be your child has any other health issues that have emerged, including having an event like a mild traumatic brain injury, and knowing them well enough to see if there's personality change or other cognitive disturbance that might make you worried. Of course, if an athlete comes off the field and is no longer using their right arm, you would hope that the parent would also notice that.
Right. Watching your child play sport, you do have to listen to them. You know, my tendency would be to toughen up, keep going. It would be my natural tendency, but you'd have to listen to them. If they really complain about their injury or really say something's hurting, you have to look at it, get the help they need. With head injuries, again, notice changes in their personalities. My daughter had a concussion in soccer 1 year, and she all of a sudden didn't know where she was, and she was making no sense. So they pulled her off the field, and I went over, and I'm like, who is this child? And she started crying, and, you know, just to change it, I'm like, she's done. I mean, there's no way we're going to put her back in that game. So if they have symptoms or signs of things that are really, you know, they're limping or they're hurting, you know, you need to pay attention to that.
But I think I'll go back to your first point today, paying attention to sort of mental health attitude changes, where sport no longer becomes fun, where their interaction, they withdraw into themselves. They want to sort of stay in dark places because there happened to be a kid with their video game, but because they're just sort of those subtle changes that may not have been an event that anyone could have seen that occurred for them. That would be true of falling off your bike. I mean, if not going to be sport. But those are things that people need to be really alert to, because it's easy to see if my arm doesn't work or I'm sort of dragging my leg a bit. But all these other things that are a part of the brain, just assigned to the concussion issue, and the mental health of students are really sort of very, very important to be attentive to.
Yeah, so if they start changing personalities, irritable, crying, any confusion or lack of, you know, they can't focus and they used to be able to focus, those are signs, you're right, that they may not pick up on themselves. And they might be saying, I don't know why I'm crying. And maybe it's because they had a head injury.
But a challenge in the whole thing, a head injury, I can understand that there is a point in contact where something happens and you do an assessment. You know, you have 4 years at Michigan State as an athlete or 4 years as a student. And you sort of have to get that freshman class and figure out where they're at in so many different aspects, health, nutrition, mental health has really got to be a challenge to get. They've got 18 years of their life out there, and now you've got them and you've got to take care of them in so many ways. It's not the old days of a trainer tapes the ankle. It's you've got to have a responsibility for trying to understand all aspects of their health and well-being.
Correct. And that's the key for us, is as we get to know them, then you do know the changes. But that freshman year is tough. We do screening at the physical time with some things for SADS, seasonal affective disorder, especially the kids that come from South that haven't been in winter before. So we'll watch them closer. But we also do some mental health screening. And if there's anything on their shows, then we will have them talk to us about that, talk to the team physician about that, to get them, you know, trying to stop it before it gets worse. Some kids come in on medications. Every time I see a doctor, we ask a few questions about mental health just to make sure that we aren't missing something there. So we're pretty attentive to it, but they do have to be honest with us too.
And you're also doing some baseline screening about conditions of the brain. And anyway, we talk about how that's changed over time as we know more about repetitive injuries as opposed to just one gigantic collision.
One of the most interesting things that I've observed here at Michigan State during the 6 years that I've been allowed to participate as a team physician is how science has been inoculated into the equation. Each of our student athletes that is involved with a contact or collision sport has computer-generated neuropsych testing to specifically baseline what their capabilities are in a very scientific way. Each of them has a complete physical examination, including neurologic examination, prior to competing. And that allows us a baseline, President Simon. If there's any alteration, we then have the baseline to determine whether or not they've suffered a concussion on that basis. So it is the intro- introduction of science into determination that's been one of the most pleasing things to have observed.
But we have to also recognize that brain science is really an evolving discipline, that we know more and more about it, and there are clearly things that as your daughter goes off and becomes a physician and finishes her PhD and physician scientist, you know, she's leaving and going out and looking at patients at a time when we know a lot more about what to look for, what genetic markers, blood markers, you know, computational data lets us put a lot of that stuff together because it isn't the same for each individual. But this is still evolving about what we can do, even with all of this testing.
The evolution of neuroscience is one of the most exciting things in front of us. The technology and the ability to probe various aspects of neurochemistry and neurophysiology have expanded in an exponential fashion. And it is without doubt the most exciting aspect of being a neurologist is realizing how far we've come literally year by year in terms of the advances that have emerged. In terms of how the brain absorbs force and dissipates force and the reaction to force, that is beginning to emerge in a more scientific way in understanding what are the long-term effects of mild traumatic brain injury, how significant are they, how much of this is hysteria, and how much of this is science. And all that is emerging as we move forward. A very exciting moment in neuroscience.
Well, I know you're both of you, a Hall of Fame trainer, both of you are very actively involved nationally in these discussions. MSU's data under your leadership and has been part of these big national studies, Big Ten, Ivy League, well before the NCAA sort of got into the mix with their medical director. And now I know you're part of the national conversations in trying to interpret and better understand all of these data.
Actually, collaboration with the Department of Defense as well.
So it's incredibly interesting that the presidents of the Big Ten and Ivy League made a decision to join forces, and the exchange of information over the last 4 years regarding the Big Ten universities and the Ivy Leagues has resulted in numerous collaborations between two great academic and athletic conferences. The most recent was in July in Philadelphia, where there was tremendous opportunity to share with individuals what is happening at Michigan State University along with its collaborating institutions. And this was on two fronts. One was the use of functional MRI to look at these advanced MRI techniques for prognosis. Once we're able to establish prognosis, then treatment strategy for mild traumatic brain injury will come next. And it's interesting, being in collaboration with Ohio State, Penn State, Purdue, Northwestern, Nebraska, sharing these data in just the most polite and innovative way off the athletic field. So when it comes down to science, the ability to collaborate is just wonderful based on these things.
I want to probably to do a pitch for Marcus Danos and his little headband. So I'll tell our listeners this is probably, you might see this as a plug. I was really impressed. So I'll say this about Sally Yu and David. Our faculty members had an idea about how to think about pressure hits, whatever you want to call it, that people might receive during a game. They had tested some helmets with some technology in them and decided that they weren't, they were calibrated for really, really significant hits, but not for the sort of persistent, I don't know what your official term is, dings or whatever you want to call it, when kids get so they're not exhibiting the huge symptoms, but it's still a challenge to make sure that we're not on a pathway of something more serious. So they came up with this headband idea. And without what I was really impressed with, without any intervention of anybody, they came over and said, will you guys try this? You know, I mean, a bunch of chemists, right? Yeah. A bunch of chemists doing nanomaterials, and then they want to grow a nanomaterial that can be can figure out how hard a collision is, and then show a red blotch on a headband so that you guys have a better chance of understanding what happens.
Yeah,
and you guys embraced it and you tried it out. Coach D'Antonio let it happen, Mark. And I think that's a culture of sort of innovation and trying to continue to find better ways to augment our already strong system.
Yes, they presented to us on the headband, and it was very intriguing, and we discussed it. You know, Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Pearson and I discussed it, and it wasn't going to interfere too much with, you know, our practice, obviously, to get us ready for a game. And the players had a volunteer, and the players, we had a group that were really good about volunteering and kept giving feedback, and they kept doing the next prototype.
This was last spring.
Yeah, we went through each day. Someone would practice with it on and then give them feedback. And I looked at it as it's a really neat idea because it's kind of a low-tech idea, so that youth would be huge for the youth population because it's not a sensor that costs thousands of dollars. It's a very affordable item, and when it gets to the market, I think that parents could then go home and pull this headband off, look at that, and say, yeah, my child's had too many 30G forces today, therefore tomorrow they're not going to hit, you know, or whatever. I think it's really for the future of youth football and maybe high school into college, I don't know, but I think it's really important to help parents identify when their child has gotten too many hits and maybe needs to back off for the hitting.
Because this is really, it detects smaller hits. I don't want to, there's no way if you bump your head, it's not a pressure, a force on your head. I mean, no matter, you know, and you get up with it, and a lot of those little ones may have as much devastating reactions as one big collision that you can identify and treat more directly. And that's what I think the research is evolving to, depending on the person. I mean, because this is all still sort of genetic dependent almost about what happens with people who have similar circumstances. But your view about what you know, so I take my headband off and it's got some red spots on it, and not a big blotch, but a red spot.
So I'd like to digress for just a second. Sally Nogol calls me up and says, I got two chemists I want you to talk to. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, what's the idea? And she tells me they're measurement scientists from the chemistry faculty, and they want to meet you in the football building. I'm thinking, what is this? And there they were, you know. They look like chemistry professors, and they talk like chemistry professors, but they're measurement scientists, and they had an idea that if you use a low-tech device, it would be all sport, all gender. Right now, football players have the ability to wear a helmet that can detect force imparted to the helmet. Their idea was all gender, all sport, so that female soccer players could use this. No computers, nothing. But by using chemistry techniques in terms of these micro balloons that change color, that you would be able to detect smaller blows to the head in a way that could be of some value as either an athletic trainer or as a team physician. It does not make the diagnosis of concussion, but as an extension of the clinical exam, I believe will be valuable. And it is, without question, one of the most interesting things of working at a university that a neurologist and an athletic trainer get in a room with two chemists and something remarkable comes out as a result. Where else could that happen? So from a clinical standpoint, in terms of disqualifying a player in real time, we are dependent upon the examination and the history. But if you have this additional thing of realizing that they've absorbed an 80G hit, that as an extension of the clinical exam would be quite valuable. An 80G hit equals a blow that would be described as substantial and could be associated with a concussion.
Okay. And a 30 is just a kind of bumping your head type.
It's still a significant hit, and it would depend on, for us, it's probably a subconcussive blow, yes.
Yeah.
For youth, it might be a blow that's significant. That's what they're be able to check was that, is it, you know, maybe the youth only, they need to really have this light up at 30 Gs, whereas for us, it's 90 Gs. Mm-hmm. I think they're very clever because it shows a star if you get into, you know, they're seeing stars if they get a significant blow. I thought that was clever on their part. But it does show you have a lot of subconcussive blows, too, and so you know that they've had a lot of hitting today, which is important to know, too.
Because maybe we don't, but maybe we just sort of protect their brain a bit by limiting some hitting tomorrow, even though there's no symptoms or sign, or even by protocol, a responsibility to take them out. If you really care about kids and their mental health and these kinds of things, it's just a good precaution.
I think that that's an interesting way to look at it. Let's look at 2 million soccer mothers throughout the United States worried about sending their daughters out to play soccer, and they hid the ball, and all the other things that happen on a soccer field, wearing a lightweight band that also would assist with control of hair and a variety of other things, and then to be able to use that same device to determine whether or not a child is winded or is in pain or actually has suffered a significant blow to the head would be a tremendous advance. And I am very enthusiastic about this. Furthermore, Drs. Blanchard and Dantos presented this at the Big Ten Ivy League meeting in July, and there were gasps. People understood immediately how the simplicity was the key. It is a low-tech, simplistic tool that will be of value. Mm-hmm. And to hear somebody from the Harvard College gasp over an advance at Michigan State, well, that was quite pleasing, that sort of thing.
But it wouldn't have happened if you all weren't open to this kind of collaboration and continuing to sort of push your own understanding of this field in ways that are pretty significant.
I think as you go through this, and those that are listening to the show, the research that's done, we talk about some of the innovative technology that's out there. Football coach is listening to the show right now. A parent is listening to the show. High school sports are just getting underway, and I understand you can't give a comprehensive medical advice answer to this question, but what are the few things that you would want to have those parents and those coaches to know where we're at in the process with concussion research and what they should be doing to be responsible coaches at the high school level?
I think the key is identifying the concussions. If you don't have a low-tech technology like the headband, you have to watch the players. You have to watch if they have symptoms, if they aren't being themselves, they have headaches or throwing, you know, any symptom, they need to be taken out of the game. That's the biggest thing. In the past, we let them sit for 5 or 10, 15 minutes, put them back in. Nowadays, they need to be taken out of the game and evaluated by a healthcare professional before they go back into that sport, whether it's soccer, field hockey, ice hockey, whatever it is, they need to be removed and checked out before they return.
I think the cultural changes that are emerging over time also, realizing that we want warriors on the playing field, but we want them to be safe warriors. And that sort of cultural change, I think, is an important thing that's coming upon us now.
We're also proud of what you do in this area and well beyond. We're appreciative of having you by our side every day, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon talking with Spartan Athletics lead trainer Sally Nogle and Spartan football team physician and MSU neurologist Dr. David Kaufman. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman. It's easy to peer into the unknown and worry, to look in the rearview mirror and regret. We can become paralyzed if we imagine some inevitable future pain we must endure, fearing that traumatic scars, real or imagined, will damage us beyond recognition. We sometimes choose to give up on a dream rather than risk the heartbreak inherent in the inevitable failures that show us the way to making them come true. How can people find seemingly unending reserves of energy and courage to try again and again, even as an objective mind tries to convince a subjective heart to give up? The Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung challenges us to remember, I am not what has happened to me. I am what I choose to become. Those choices can make all the difference. Choose to believe that the scars are nothing more than tattoos with better stories. We are all warriors, and every warrior has them. Choose not to be a victim of your pain and struggle. Choose instead to go into battle to become someone else's hero. To paraphrase Emery Austin, some days there won't be a song in your heart. Choose to sing anyway. Choose to concentrate only on the one time and place over which you have total control. Choose how you react to the here and now. A very small percentage of people in this world will actually experience and live today, writes Steve Maraboli in his book Unapologetically You, Reflections on Life and Human Experience. So many people, he says, will be stuck on another day, another time that traumatized them and caused them to spiritually stutter, so they miss out on this day. As for future fears, Bishop Bielby Porteous gave us the wisdom in the 1700s. He said, "He who foresees calamities suffers them twice over. And oh, how we love to live anywhere but the present. We'll hear a song that reminds us of how we mishandled a relationship, and we relive it like it was yesterday. We'll see something that brings back a painful memory and replay the tape inside our heads at full volume. If at first we don't succeed, we may try again. But most things worth achieving require lots of trying. Fear of failure raises its ugly head and does its best to frighten us into losing focus, shutting down, avoiding necessity, giving up. So what do you fear? What triggers past regrets? When you step outside of your conscious mind and look at your fears from the point of view of a witness instead of a participant, how are they different? It's actually essential to allow yourself to fully feel the fear, to examine the root causes of your sorrow and regret. But do so with the wisdom of the now. The gift of experience is context. With time and reflection, we can forgive others and ourselves for past mistakes. We can feed the energy of faith that manifests the courage to do what needs to be done. Everything we experience can help us more clearly understand the suffering of others and develop a deeper appreciation of what we were put on this earth to do. It's easy to picture courage as a powerful echo across the canyons of doubt and distress. This isn't necessarily so. Author Marianne Rademacher tells us that courage does not always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day singing, "I will try again tomorrow." So whatever your current situation, your task is to make your life a work of art that will be admired and inspire others. It will be hard work, but anything exceptional requires exceptional effort. Some long-forgotten sage threw down this gauntlet. At any given moment, you have the power to say this is not how the story is going to end. And there is only one moment in which you can write the next chapter, the now. I'm Scott Westerman at scottwesterman.com. Now you've heard it. Go out and do it.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.